Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Good morning and welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Reminding you about Streetwise Hebrew for the Times of Israel community, our bite-sized audio Hebrew classes. Today is Tuesday, November 30th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. It's the second day of Chanukah. We're joined today by military correspondent Judah Ari Gross and environmental reporter Sue Sirks. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jessica.
Hi. So just a quick look at what we're going to cover today. Judah's recent trip to Morocco with Defense Minister Benny Gantz. Sue's coverage of fireworks at the Knesset Internal Affairs and Environmental Committee. And looking at the plans for new marinas around Israel. Sue has more to tell us about that. Judah, let's get started with you talking about Morocco. Rereading your pieces sounded like a very fascinating trip, both from a personal and professional point of view. Start wherever you would like.
Sure. So last Tuesday, Defense Minister Benny Gantz and his sort of entourage, along with a dozen or so Israeli journalists, or Israeli and international journalists, flew from Israel to Rabat, the capital of Morocco, landed there sort of first thing Wednesday morning and spent two pretty full days in the Moroccan capital. This was the second trip by an Israeli elected official, sort of the third big delegation from Israel to Morocco since the two countries, again, re-normalized ties continues. It depends on the nomenclature is significant, but Israel and Morocco have had an interesting history for decades now where the two have maintained ties with one another, but not very openly, but also not that quietly either. And, you know, tens of thousands of Israelis were able to travel between the two countries, you know, even when they didn't sort of have these formal, open, you know, big diplomatic ties. So this was still the early days. And this trip was meant to, during the trip, Gantz signed a memorandum of understanding with Morocco, which is apparently the first memorandum of understanding of this type that Israel has signed with an Arab country, even though it has sort of great military, you know, security ties with Egypt and Jordan, and now growing ones with the UAE and Bahrain. But this was meant to formalize a lot of the ways that the two countries' militaries and defense ministries and security services coordinate and talk to one another. Because in the past, before this was in place, most of the dialogue between the two countries was happening through the two countries' intelligence services and sort of at these very high levels. And now it sort of brings it down to where the IDF can directly speak to the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces and things like that. It also allows Morocco to more easily buy weapons from Israeli arms manufacturers. And it sort of just sets up, you know, allows for them to form, you know, joint teams on different issues and develop joint defense projects, both in terms of on intelligence issues, but then also in terms of developing weapons systems with one another and things like that. The first day of the trip sort of dealt specifically with that. You know, Gantz met with his counterpart in the defense minister of Morocco, and with the head of the military. He also met with the foreign minister. He met with a few other army officers, and then sort of first thing on the second day, he met with the head of Morocco's Mossad, sort of its intelligence service. And later in the day, on the second day, Gantz went to a, I wouldn't say defunct, but sort of a pretty pretty bare synagogue in Rabat. There is still a Jewish community in Morocco of a few, you know, low thousands number of people, a lot of them sort of older. And in Rabat especially so, there's maybe a few dozen sort of at most Jews who still live in the city. They don't normally put together a minyan definitely not for the days of the week, and normally not for Shabbat and things like that. But sort of the synagogue is still there. It's still, you know, it's still open. And so he visited there, and it was sort of an interesting thing that you have these, you know, on the one hand, the synagogue in Morocco feels very, very familiar. I mean, there's a lot of the similar sort of decorations and trappings that you're used to seeing in a Moroccan or in a Mizrahi sort of in general synagogue. But then there's a few things that make you realize 100% that you're still inside Morocco. Right. Two of them being giant portraits of the king right at the front of the sanctuary, as well as a Moroccan flag alongside an Israeli flag. And then sort of during our trip, the cantor of the synagogue, Gabriel Derry, recited both a prayer for the well-being of the king, of King Muhammad VI, as well as a king, a prayer for the state of Israel, and sort of somewhat bizarrely for a country that, only recently developed ties with one another openly, a prayer for the well-being of IDF soldiers. And sort of making that even more so interesting was the fact that there were, in uniform IDF soldiers in the room with us. There were three members of sort of Gantz's entourage are IDF officers. Two of them are of Moroccan heritage. One of them, Yaki Dolf, is who's been sort of a longtime right-hand man to Gantz. Both of his parents are from Morocco. Another officer who was along for the trip, his mother is from Morocco and moved to Israel in 1961.
Had they ever been in Morocco before?
I'm not sure about Yaki Dolf. Uh-huh. The other officer, he hadn't, but his mother had been back before. Wow. But both of them, you could very clearly see, there was also a few journalists who were of sort of Moroccan extraction. And you could see that this wasn't sort of just another work trip for them to a certain extent. There's a lot of resonance. There's not a lot of Arab countries that Jews fled that they're now able to sort of freely, openly, happily go back to. Egypt is kind of the one, but there's definitely just the way in which Israel has ties with Egypt. It's very much a military to military, sort of government to government ties. And it's very not, it's really not a people to people sort of peace. The public sentiment in Egypt is still very, very not pro-Israel.
Yeah, right.
In Morocco, I don't think the Moroccan public is not necessarily very pro-Israel, but you could see that this was a much more open sort of relationship than Israel has with Egypt. So the fact that, Israelis have been going back to Morocco on sort of heritage tours and things like that, but especially now that there's direct flights. And
how was the food?
The food was exceptional. I have to give a personal shout out to the Moroccan Armed Forces for supplying kosher food from a kosher caterer in Rabat to the Israeli delegation. It was sort of all the roasted lamb and couscous with dried fruits and all kinds of different pastries baked and fried. It was an exceptional spread. thank you to them. Thank you to them for that. But on the military side, these sort of renewed ties are expected to bring in hundreds of millions of dollars to Israeli weapons manufacturers. It's sort of what's one of the things that's Israeli officials are sort of most excited about, sort of in terms of this relationship, is that it's not. I don't want to belittle the relationship that Israel is developing with the UAE and Bahrain and other countries in the Gulf, but there you can sort of see the relationship is built a little bit more on a quid pro quo kind of a thing. They're facing a similar enemy of Iran. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more. They want something out of the relationship. Israel wants something out of the relationship in terms of building a coalition against Iran. Of Arab countries in the Gulf, in the region. Whereas with Morocco, Israel and Morocco don't really share any specific enemies in terms of an immediate tactical level. Both countries are facing things with global jihad and Al Qaeda, but they're different branches, different parts of Al Qaeda that Morocco is facing versus Israel in Sinai and Syria. And there's some question about Iranian involvement with Algeria, which is the country that's sort of most threatening to Morocco over its conflict in the Western Sahara. And, there's some connection sort of on the Iranian front, on the Al-Qaeda front. But, what's exciting to Israeli officials about it is that this isn't an exchange. This isn't something that's built around one particular issue, but something that they're trying to build sort of wider networks of connections about so that this
can
last. A real relationship. And they're trying, in the meantime, to get roots sort of in Morocco and get Moroccan roots in Israel to really entrench the relationship as much as possible so that it's less likely that the two countries will sort of have a falling out as they did in the past.
Okay. Makes sense. Really interesting stuff. Thanks, Judah. So moving on to you and your report that went up early this morning, very early, about, so to speak, fireworks at the Knesset Internal Affairs and Environmental Committee with the Katsa people, the state company that inked a contentious deal with the United Arab Emirates, speaking of, to transport its oil from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. Could you explain a little bit more about that? And we've spoken about it before, but it's always good to have a reminder of the basic details before we go into actually what's been happening over the last couple of days.
So the deal was signed in the immediate aftermath of the Abraham Accords last year. And it's a commercial deal between a state company called the Europe-Asia Pipeline Company and a consortium of Israeli and UAE businessmen called Red Med. It was kind of celebrated, flouted at the time as something that's part of the Abraham Accords. It is not part of the Abraham Accords. It is a commercial deal, but it is a state company, and there is massive, massive opposition to it in Israel because, first of all, oil is, you know, as they say, the fuel of yesterday. Secondly, people claim it's going to come through the country, come in one end, go out the other, and therefore not even benefit the population. And thirdly, obviously, the fear of oil spills. The company was responsible for the biggest environmental disaster in Israel in 2014 when there was a pipeline leak in a nature reserve. Its pipeline network actually crosses a number of nature reserves in the south. We're talking between Eilat on the Red Sea and Ashkelon on the Mediterranean. It's also a very secretive company. It was originally set up under a different name to channel oil from the Shah's Iran through Israel to Europe. And the secrecy has been maintained, even though the conditions have changed. So yesterday, the chairman and the CEO of this company had a chance to put their point of view at the Knesset committee. Obviously, most of the other people there were opposed to the deal. We heard from Erez Chalfon, who's the chairman, and from Itzik Levy, who's the CEO. And they made clear that according to the law, or what they claimed at least, was that the government ministries, and we have to remember that none of the ministries have seen the details of the agreement, government ministries, they said, never see commercial deals of state companies. They are obliged only to report to their board, on which sits a representative of the government company's authority and the accountant general of the finance ministry. Now, even when the finance ministry was asked through a campaign for freedom of information to provide the agreement, it claimed that it had no information. So the information appears to be only sort of outside of, you know, other board members, only with those two representatives on the committee.
What's the attitude of the politicians, of the Knesset members, to this secrecy? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, that it's absolutely appalling. And in fact, the representative that was there of the government company's authorities said that both he and the company don't think that the secrecy is helpful because it leads to disinformation. It leads to people believing that decisions have been made in the dark. In fact, the representative of the government company's authority said that the EAPC has been acting perfectly legally.
Uh-huh. Wow. That sounds kind of astounding, but clearly not in this situation. In other words, you know, they've been allowed to operate all along.
Exactly. In other words, there's a difference between the narrow reading of the law, possibly, although there is a petition into the High Court about this, whether their behavior was legal or wasn't legal. That petition was submitted earlier this year by three environmental organizations. So, you know, we're waiting for a judgment on that. But at the committee, it was kind of, you know, you saw this difference between the narrow legal interpretation and the broader interpretation, right, according to what you might call natural law, which is that with a proposal that has such profound implications for the environment, for tourism, for public health. And we know that Katsa has a very blotchy record. In fact, the CEO and the chairman claimed that in 40 years, the company had never had a leak in the Eilat port, which was kind of poo-pooed, you know, by the environmental ministry that has other information. It also claimed that it's fulfilled all of the environmental conditions set by the environmental ministry, which is plainly not the case, according to the ministry, which earlier this year said that the company was disregarding environmental concerns and would be limited to the number of ships that it could bring in because of that, because it's failed to fulfill two environmental surveys. So there's a huge gap between the ministry right. and the company.
Okay. And on that front of things being constructed and built that don't necessarily make sense, at least not to our eyes or ears, you're writing about the construction or the planning for new marinas around Israel. I'm assuming this is a bad thing, but why don't you tell us what you think or what you found?
Certainly for environmentalists, it's a bad thing. It's something that I'm just looking into now. You can argue as well, environmental activists are also often social activists, that essentially if you take large swathes of coast and fence it off for those who are able to afford yachts, then right. you're denying, you know, a public space to the public. But there are also all sorts of environmental harms that are caused by marinas, which are recognized worldwide, you know, one of which is that it disturbs the movement of the sand. You're blocking the movement of the sand, which in our case goes northwards, because you're building walls and therefore you have to schlep new sand in and what have you. You're also, right. you're disrupting all sorts of coastal behavior, coastal ecological behavior. You're damaging coastal habitats. You know, these are very sensitive areas. Also in Israel, many of them are rocky. We've got fish, we've got animals, we've got habitats of birds, et cetera, et cetera. The National Planning Council is reacting to a report from the Ports and Shipping Authority, which says that there's been quite a substantial increase in the use of small boats. But, you know, we already have mooring possibilities in a lot of places up and down the coast, from Akko in the north down to Ashkelon in the south, a huge marina in Herzliya, another one in Jaffa Port. You know, there's a lot of places where boats can moor. They're now planning to, they're looking at a number of other sites, which include Nahariya in the north, Bat Galim in Haifa, Hadera in Netanya. They're all kind of northern and central, to add, you know, possibly another 2,600 spaces, which wow. seems pretty crazy. So there's a meeting ongoing now, which a lot of the environmentalists will be. It's a meeting that is not open to the press. And they will be trying to put their case against new marinas and to say that the needs can be met by expanding the current marinas and just leave the rest alone.
Right. There's not enough coastline anyway, as it is.
There's not enough coastline. And also, unfortunately, there are plans to build residential housing on the coastline.
Right, right. Okay, Sue, we depend on you to bring us that news and those updates. Thank you to both of you guys. Thanks, Judah. Thanks, Sue, for being with us today at the Daily Briefing. Reminder, sign up for Streetwise Hebrew by becoming a member of the Times of Israel community at our website. Wishing you a Chanukah Sameach if you celebrate, and otherwise have a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.